The main thing I want to talk about is how to use this technique of co-cycle reduction. And because it's just a proof technique and not something in particular to prove, we got to have something we're aiming for. So I'm going to try to get through the proof of this theorem of Simon Thomas. Let's see, it says there is a countable Borel equivalence relation E, so that two things are true about it. First one is that N disjoint copies of E are strictly Borel reduce, whatever you call this ordering, Borel reducibility order, strictly below N plus 1 copies of E. And so that the relation we get when we replace each point of X by just two points that are still related is not one-to-one Borel reducible to E. So let me just say precisely what we mean by N times E. Actually, let's just do, we're actually just going to do this for 1 and 2, and the proof for N and N plus 1 is the same. So 2E and E cross I2 are both on some space X cross 2, and they're defined by XI is 2E to YJ if XEY and I equals J. All right, so we just take two copies of X and put E on each one. And the E cross I2 is the opposite thing. Where we just ignore the second coordinate, and XI is related to YJ if X is related to Y. So, and this symbol means reducible by a one-to-one Borel reduction, one-to-one Borel function. All right, so now that I've defined everything, this is our first goal. Now, it's going to turn out that along the way, we'll prove another theorem. It's actually the same. We use the same E and the same proof technique to prove the theorem of Scott Adams, that there are countable Borel equivalence relations E and F, so that E is a subset of F and E is not Borel reducible to F. So we use the same E for the Adams proof as well as the two parts of the Simon or the Thomas proof. And we'll just prove them all because it's all the same thing anyway, except for the details at the end. So let's see. We're going to do this by co-cycle reduction, so I probably should tell you what a co-cycle is. So alpha, oh wait, before I start this, want to make a comment that throughout E, F are countable Borel equivalence relations. Just if I forget to mention it. And X and Y are Borel spaces. And yeah, okay, that's about it. Oh wait, no. And gamma and H are countable groups. All right, and usually gamma is going to act on X, H is going to act on Y in a Borel way. All right, so let me define. Start over here. Alpha is a function from gamma cross X into H is a cocycle if it's a Borel function and it looks like a homomorphism, except we have this extra coordinate. So for all gamma and delta in capital gamma, we have that alpha of gamma delta comma x is the same as alpha of gamma delta dot x times alpha of delta x. And this is, well, I forgot to mention, we always have a measure mu that is gamma invariant. All right, so it looks like a homomorphism. Essentially, if we ignore the x pieces, then, or if we ignore the second coordinate here everywhere, we've got alpha of gamma delta is the same as alpha of gamma times alpha of delta. But we do have to deal with this extra x, because alpha is going to tell us how gamma acts on x, not just how gamma gets mapped into H. So in some sense, alpha captures the action of gamma on x. And in a more precise sense, let's see, let me define this first. So if we pick a homomorphism between let me draw a picture. So we've got gamma is acting on x, and we have H over here, and it's going to be easier if we think about H acting on some space Y. And over here we get this equivalence relation E X gamma, and over here we get an equivalence relation E Y H. Now we have a homomorphism, what do we call it, rho. It's a homomorphism of equivalence relations, so it maps any two things that are related here, their image is related here. And what we would like is some homomorphism from gamma to H so that the action of gamma on X looks like the image of the action of gamma on Y. You can't necessarily do that because gamma could act in different ways on different pieces of X. So instead what we get is a function which combines information from gamma and X. That's this alpha. And so essentially this diagram commutes so that the action of gamma on X gives a, or sorry, gamma and X gives us an element of H through alpha, and the action of H on the image of the thing in X, I'll write this out in a second, is the same as the action of gamma on H on X. So define, so if rho is a homomorphism of E x gamma to e y h, then alpha is the cocycle associated with rho if alpha tells us how to act on y. So make sure I get this right. Alpha of gamma and x dot rho of x is equal to rho of gamma dot x. All right. Actually, this is called the strict cocycle. And that's just because it happens everywhere, not just mu, almost everywhere. All right, so alpha essentially tells us exactly what, after we map through with rho, it tells exactly what gamma does to x in the context of h acting on y. So, what's that? No. Well, it's the cocycle. Oh, well, I suppose. All right. Sure. There may be more than one. And I want to say what we want to call two cocycles equivalent in some cases. So we say beta is equivalent to alpha if there's a Borel map from x to some h of x, so that for all gamma in gamma, alpha of gamma x equals h gamma dot x beta of gamma x h inverse of x, mu almost everywhere. All right, so this just tells us when two cocycles essentially do the same thing, it will become a little more clear why this makes them equivalent. All right, and now there's this nice trick that if alpha is associated in this sense, if alpha is associated with rho and beta is equivalent to alpha, then we can, let's see, we can move our rho over a little bit and get a homomorphism associated with beta so that the homomorphism sends things in x to the same equivalence class in y that that rho does. So it doesn't move things too much. Let me write that down. So let's see. So in this case, and rho associated with alpha, we get sigma of x which is just apply this h of x, h inverse of x to the other homomorphism rho. This is also a homomorphism, and moreover, sigma of x is e y h to rho of x. So essentially, we can, if we have another cocycle that's equivalent to alpha, we can move our homomorphism around a little and get one associated with beta. Oh wait, I didn't say that yet. Right, and this is and sigma is associated with beta. right, that's the important bit. So anyway, it tells us we can move stuff around a little bit, and it still can look fairly nice. All right. Now, one or two more definitions. So we say that F is alpha invariant. This is pretty much the standard what you'd expect for a definition of invariant. If and only if F is mu measurable and for all gamma alpha of gamma x dot F of x equals F of gamma dot x mu almost everywhere. And the reason I wanted to write this definition down is just to remark that it looks a lot like the definition of a homomorphism being associated with a cocycle. That's essentially what we want. F is going to be almost a homomorphism associated with the cocycle. All right. And now our first interesting theorem is called the cocycle reduction lemma, I guess. And this says if EX gamma is EYH ergodic, I'll say what that is in a sec, alpha from gamma cross X to H is a Borel cocycle, and F from X to Y is alpha invariant and mu measurable, then there is some Y naught in Y and beta equivalent to alpha, so that the image of beta, or the image of gamma cross X, is a subset of H sub Y naught, which is equal to this is the stabilizer of Y naught in H. Right. So, first off, one equivalence relation, EX gamma is EYH ergodic, means that for any Borel homomorphism from X to Y, almost everything gets mapped into the same EYH class. So it's like being, instead of everything gets mapped to a set of measure one with normal ergodic, everything gets mapped into the same class, almost everything. Did I say that right? No, right. Let me write it down just in case. I don't know if I said it right. Actually, I read it here. We're saying for all homomorphisms of E to F, there's one Y naught in Y so that rho of X is almost everywhere related to Y. All right. So almost everything gets mapped into the same class. So it's not really surprising. This result isn't all that surprising when you realize that we're assuming almost everything goes into one class here. So what we really want to say is this element is in the class, and we're mapping almost everything into the class around y naught, so there's some way to make it all get mapped exactly to y naught without moving our homomorphism around a whole lot. Do the proof of this. So we say on a co-null set X naught, F is a homomorphism from EX gamma restricted to X naught to EYH, and this is because it's alpha invariant. So if we had two things, let's see. Say we have one E equivalence class here, sorry, EX gamma equivalence class, and two EYH equivalence classes, and F takes guys to different spots here. We know that F is alpha invariant, so we know that there's some gamma that takes this guy to that guy. So we look at the image of that gamma, and so this is X. So you look at alpha of gamma X will take the image of X to the other guy here. So in particular, these two have to be in the same equivalence class. Almost everywhere, right? We only know it's almost everywhere invariant. So that tells us that it almost has to be a homomorphism, or a homomorphism on a set of measure 1. So by the EYH ergodicity, we know there is some y naught, right? We just said that there's some y naught, so everything gets mapped to that, or it gets mapped to the same class. Well, yeah, okay. YH. So mu almost everywhere, in particular, mu almost everywhere in X naught, we could assume X naught is everything, or sorry, X naught is everything that this is true for. Now we're going to let this function that takes X to H sub X be a Borel function so that F of X equals H sub X inverse Y naught. Right, since we know F sub X is in the same class as Y naught, we can find some function in H, or sorry, some element of H that moves F sub X, or right, moves F sub X to Y naught. And since there's only countably many functions in H, we can pick this to be a Borel function or Borel mapping. And now we define beta. So that beta of gamma X is H gamma dot X alpha of gamma X H inverse of X. So alpha is equivalent to beta. And beta of gamma X applied to Y naught is equal to Y naught, mu almost everywhere. So now, since beta acts on y naught by sending it back to y naught, beta is in the stabilizer of y naught, and we've got almost everything's in this stabilizer. All right. Oh, and then we can, all right. Then we take we move beta around a little bit to make all the bad stuff get mapped to 1. So then everything moves into the stabilizer of y naught. All right, so this is sort of the basic idea of all of these theorems, is we're going to take some pair of equivalence relations and the co-cycle between them and move it around a little bit so that all of a sudden everything looks like it gets mapped into some small subgroup of the image group. And then we're going to use that to get contradiction. So, let's see. So I'll erase this. That's the eraser everyone else hates, I think. So our main tool for working with these co-cycle reductions is this theorem. I should mention that all of the things I'm talking about today are from this paper of Hjorth and Kekris. Let me write the citation. It's called Rigidity Theorems for Actions of Product Groups and countable Borel equivalence relations. And it's a preprint on Kekris's website if you want to get it. So this theorem, I'm assuming that this is from, I think this is by Hjorth and Kekris. And this is the main tool they use to prove a lot of these rigidity results. So let's see, it's a long one. So gamma is a countable group. Delta is a normal amenable subgroup. See, gamma acts on X in a Borel way. Let's see, and we have an invariant measure mu. The action is E0 ergodic. The action of delta is plane ergodic. And H is a near hyperbolic group, which I'll talk about in a minute. And alpha is a cocycle from gamma cross X into H. The Borel cocycle. I'm going to need another board. Then we have two options. Either number one, there is a cocycle beta equivalent to alpha so that beta of our whole space is a subset of H naught, which is an amenable subgroup of H. And this is the case that we'll construct our groups to avoid in the application of the theorem. And the other case is there's a way to get delta cross X. The way to get delta cross X into a finite subset. And in this case, let's see, we can define pi of gamma is this funny double coset, so that this coset only depends on gamma. Mu almost everywhere. And what we really are going to use later is if H is torsion free, we can assume that F naught is 1. So there's a homomorphism pi from gamma to H, so that pi of delta is the trivial group and pi is equivalent to alpha. All right. So this is sort of ugly when you first look at it, but really what we're going to end up doing is construct a bunch of groups. We're going to construct a gamma and delta and H so that 1 can't happen because amenable is too nice. So we get 2, and in our case, H is going to be torsion free, so we get 2 prime. And in this case, delta gets mapped to some trivial group. And so that'll tell us something about all of gamma. And that'll tell us, what we'll end up getting is that the measure that we've defined on gamma is the same as the measure that we get on H. All right, so before we go on, I'm actually not going to prove this, mainly because near hyperbolic comes up, and I don't really want to define near hyperbolic or work with it. But essentially near hyperbolic, it's a generalization of hyperbolic, which is a generalization of free. So free groups and free products of finite groups. Let's see, there's a few other things that are near hyperbolic, and essentially everything that we're going to care about is near hyperbolic. And the actual definition of near hyperbolic, let me write down what it is, and we can see to some degree how to prove this theorem. So let's see. So it's near hyperbolic if there is some K, a compact metric space. So first H acts on K, but really we don't care about the action on K. We care about the action on the space of measures on K. Let's see. Which we're going to call M of K. And what it says is we can partition M of K into two pieces. the measures with support on two or fewer points and the measures with support on three or more points. And H on acting on the, let's see, whatever, the ones with small support, we're going to call M2 for two or less. As M acts on the ones with small support, it has amenable stabilizers. And is the equivalence relation is lambda hyperfinite. Measures lambda, and on the measures with bigger support, we get that it has finite stabilizers. And the equivalence relation is tame. All right, now, I'm not going to prove this. Why did I bother to define it? Well, so now we can see sort of how we're going to prove this theorem. Essentially, we're going to say, let's see. So the amenable case here essentially is when we have a map into the M2K piece of the measures, right? Okay, so first off, we draw our diagram where H is acting on MK. And either our cocycle sends almost everything into the M2 piece, where everything's got amenable stabilizers, and so we can pull this out. Or it sends something into the M3 piece, and in that case, we can do some fooling around with ergodicity, and we get into this case where everything's got finite stabilizers. Let's see, what do I mean by lambda hyperfinite? Actually, I don't remember. I just wrote down the definition he has. Yeah. All right, thanks. I mean, it really, what I wanted to get across is, all right. So if you want to know what the proof is, I can give you the paper. But I'd rather look at how we use this theorem than how to prove it. All right. So, right. Basic idea is we either get everything jammed into an amenable group, or we get our large piece jammed into a finite group. All right. Now, let's go back and look at how we prove this result. The first result, the second result, the one by Adams that I erased. Oh, well. So this is, we want to get two equivalence relations, E and F, so that E is a subset of F, but E is not reducible to F. And we're going to end up using this main theorem. So first we want to, let's set up what we're going to talk about. So first, fix group H2, which is countable, torsion-free, hyperbolic, contains a copy of F2, and cannot be mapped homomorphically onto a non-abelian free group. All right, so how do we know if such a thing exists? Well, we can say that it's equal to this group, the free group on two generators, but where we mod out by this word. Why this word? Because it gives us all that other stuff. So I think we can get the copy of F2. That's not too bad. F2 looks like A23, B23, and A46, B46. That'll give us a copy of F2. It's torsion free because this word that we're modding out by is not a power. Let's see. So I think the real trick, okay, so hyperbolic, actually it's hyperbolic because it's close enough to a free group. The reason that we use 22 is so that you can make sure it's not mapped homomorphically onto a non-abelian free group. And there's some group theory there that I don't quite know. I'm trying to remember. So it's essentially that if you could map it homomorphically onto a non-abelian free group, you'd get that A and B generate the free group, and we know that they don't because we can make this word that's not, that is the identity in the group. So anyway, this one works. I believe it. And now we're going to define H. It's going to be the free group on two generators cross this one. And we're going to define gamma is F2 cross itself. And we can see this as a subgroup of H because we got a copy of F2 in there. And we're going to look at the free part of the shift action. So we'll look at H acting on 2 to the H. Right, this means the free part, so we drop out any parts of 2 to the h where that are fixed by non-1 elements of h. And we make mu the usual product measure on 2 to the h. Now, first off, this action is mixing, which means if you get far enough away from 1. In other words, if you get outside any large enough finite group, there we go, you can, or the limit as you go far enough away from 1, the action will move any group or any set far enough away from itself so that the intersection is empty or it has zero measure eventually. So what that says is that every infinite subgroup of this group is ergodic, which is nice because that seems to relate to our main theorem. We want things to be ergodic. And every non-abelian subgroup is E0 ergodic, which is a non-trivial fact that I'll just state. So we have every infinite subgroup is ergodic, and every non-amenable, I say abelian, every non-amenable group is E0 ergodic. lost that piece. Okay, so this group, this is why we like this theorem, is because it talks exactly about this kind of group. But we're not quite ready to begin the work. We still have to fix an X subset of free part of this so that, let's see, first off, we want it to be H invariant, Borel, and with measure 1, so that each cyclic subgroup of H acts uniquely ergodically on it. So uniquely ergodic just means there's only one there's only one invariant measure on X, and it has to be ergodic. There's only one. So we can do this because for each cyclic subgroup, we can find a set of measure 1 which H acts uniquely ergodically on. Now, there's only countably many cyclic subgroups, so we can take countable intersection and get a common one. So now this is the X that we're going to act on, and H and gamma are both going to act on it. So we're going to define our E is the equivalence relation given by gamma acting on X, and F is the equivalence relation given by H acting on X. Now, since gamma is actually a subgroup of H, EX gamma is going to be a subset of EXH, so a subequivalence relation. So we're done half of the Adams theorem. We found one equivalence relation that's a subset of the other. That was easy. Now we have to show that E is not Borel reducible to H. F, sorry. E is not Borel reducible to F. All right, so assume not and pick a reduction. So rho is going to be a function from X to X. So X, E, Y, if and only if rho X, E, rho Y, F, rho Y. Notice it can't be the identity, of course, since H makes more stuff equivalent than E, than gamma, sorry. All right, and let alpha be the cocycle associated with rho. All right, now we're ready to start our work. I like that these boards are called light lift. Like lifting bricks. All right, so the first thing we want to show is that we can find a... We're going to find a restriction of alpha to a particular cyclic subgroup where it looks like a homomorphism, where alpha looks like a homomorphism. So we claim that, let's see, alpha restricted to A cross 1 cross X is equivalent to some pi where pi is a function from A cross 1 to H is a non-trivial homomorphism. Oops. All right. And this, by A here we write alpha is a function taking, alpha is a function taking elements of gamma cross X into X. So what I mean here is one of the two generators of the free group in the first part of gamma, and just the identity in the second part of the free, in the second free group, second part of gamma. Right. All right. So to prove this claim, we're going to use the main theorem there. First, we're going to trying to think of how many of these I can get away with. So we want alpha 1, 1. I'll write at least one of them. The function we get when we restrict to the first coordinate, or sorry, the first generator of the first free group, and map to and project onto F2, which is the first coordinate of H, right? So this is where we're referring to 1 here and 1 here. Alpha 1, 2, we take the same thing here. Did I do this right? Right, alpha 1, 2, okay. All right, so 1, 1 takes the first thing here to F2, 1, 2 takes the first thing here to H2, and then not quite what you'd think here. We actually want one of the two generators. We want the second of the two Fs here, and then 2, 2 is the other obvious thing. All right, and the claim is that, the main theorem implies that one of these two is equivalent to a homomorphism which is trivial on A cross 1 and has non-amenable image, range, whatever. All right, so why should this be true? How is that? Anyway, so, all right, so the first thing to notice is that none of these guys are equivalent to co-cycles that take values in amenable subgroups of H. So why should that be? It's essentially because rho is Borel reduction of EX gamma to EXH. So none of these guys can give us an amenable subgroup. So we're going to apply this main theorem with gamma equal to A cross F2 and delta equal A cross 1. All right, so let's go over here and look. So we meet all these conditions. You can check them if you want. And we get either, we get a cocycle where everything gets mapped into an amenable group, or we get a cocycle where everything gets mapped to, or where the small bit gets mapped to 1. Well, we just said we can't get everything mapped to an amenable group, just because everything essentially is getting mapped to F2 cross H2, or in this case, actually just A cross F2 gets mapped to something cross F2, which is not amenable. So we can't have this first condition. So we have to have, or whatever, first result, we have to have the second one. So we get a pi, which is a homomorphism equivalent to alpha, where A cross 1 gets mapped to 1, and it has a non-amenable image, again, just because the image can't be amenable from what we said before. So okay, we get one of these guys is equivalent to homomorphism like this. Now we do the same thing on these two. Same situation, same result. And the claim is, so okay, let's just pick one of these. Say it happens on A11 or alpha 11. The claim is that then it also has to happen on alpha 2-2. So why is that? Well, if it happens on alpha 1-1 and alpha 2-1, then we've got a homomorphism from, let's see, this is where I get a little confused. Oh, that's because on these two, so say it happens on alpha 1-1, alpha 2-1, then we get a homomorphism that takes F2 cross A into F2 and is trivial, let's say pi, trivial on 1 cross A. But we already know the pi for this one is trivial on A cross 1. So that gives us a homomorphism that in... I almost got this wrong. So that gives us that alpha restricted to A cross singleton 1 cross X. Well, in this case, it's trivial, or it's equivalent to something trivial. In this case, it's equivalent to something that is non-trivial. And that can't happen. So, actually, I guess I'm going to skip the proof that that can't happen, but actually in the case where essentially we have an action of Z here, in the case where Z acts freely and we have an invariant measure and a cocycle and, well, in this case, alpha can't be equivalent to both a trivial and a non-trivial homomorphism. I'd rather get on to more the rest of the proof instead of going through that. But so that gives us a contradiction. So in particular, we have to have something like alpha 1-1 and alpha 2-2 both have this fact true. I missed a line. So we want to call this homomorphism pi. All right. No, I didn't miss a line. Okay, call this homomorphism pi. We already did that. Oh, okay, here we go. Right. All right, so this is where we reduce something to a small group. Now we want to go back and erase the near hyperbolic stuff. So now we're going to go back and modify our original alpha so that it looks like this pi. So, or not alpha, sorry, modify rho. Rho is our homomorphism. So we're going to modify rho to sigma. So that rho x is always related to sigma x, well, almost always. And so the beta associated with sigma is equal to pi. On this group where pi is defined. And x almost everywhere, whatever, mu almost everywhere. All right, so we can do this. This is what we did back at the beginning. We talked about cocycle reduction. We start with our cocycle alpha. We get a homomorphism that looks a lot like alpha. We can move alpha and the rho over. So we get a new beta. Beta looks the same as alpha, and the homomorphism associated with beta is that one. It gives us the same equivalence classes as our original homomorphism. All right, so, oh, and so we'll also have beta is equivalent to alpha. And we're going to define a new measure. Hey, a new measure, call it new. That's sort of funny. And it's the, it's essentially the image under sigma of mu, right? We take the inverse, we want to measure something under nu, we take its inverse image under sigma, and measure that. Gives us this new measure nu. And now I want to claim that, I got this backwards. I'm going to define Z is the image of A cross 1. And we're going to claim that this is nu is Z invariant. So, fine. Okay, anyway. All right, so it's Z because it looks like a copy of Z, of course. I want to, before I prove this is actually pretty easy, but before I prove it, I just want to say what this will give us is on Z, nu looks the same as our original measure, mu, and let's see, from the way we picked X, we know that each cyclic subgroup of H acts uniquely ergodically on X, so there's only one measure. So this measure nu must be the right measure. Since it's equal to mu, mu must be the measure for all of this. Mu must be equal to the image of, right, did I get this right? Mu must be equal to nu everywhere, that's the point. All right, so then, I guess I can't finish it all up right now. All right, so anyway, we'll get that nu is equal to mu. That's the whole point of this. And the proof of this claim is fairly easy. We just want to fix a Borel subset of X, and we're going to measure it. So for gamma, in A cross 1, delta equals the image of gamma in Z. We have that sigma inverse of delta on A is gamma of sigma inverse on A. Gamma? Yeah, right. So I mean, this is the definition of our measure. No, wait, this is the definition of our measure nu. Hang on. So now we have that nu of delta dot A is mu of sigma inverse of delta dot A. And this is the definition of nu. So this is the same as mu of gamma of sigma inverse of A, which is the same as mu of sigma inverse of A, which is the same as nu of A. All right, so let's see, why are all these true? So this first equality is just the definition of nu. Let's see, the second equality is because sigma is a homomorphism. Oh, wait, because it's mu invariant. Oh, wait, am I saying this right? What am I doing? Right, these are the same set. So then we can take the gamma out because gamma is mu invariant. Then we're back to the definition of nu. All right. So that tells us for any Borel A in there, the measure after acting on it by one of these elements of z is the same as the measure when we started, so nu has to be z invariant. All right. Now, so now we can conclude, like I said, that this nu is actually the same thing as mu. So after acting with sigma, or sorry, after moving things around with sigma, we get the same measure. All right. So, see, by unique a unique ergodicity on cyclic subgroups, mu equals nu. So in particular, the measure of the image of X is equal to 1. Remember, X is our space. So this tells us that not only is, I guess we've moved from rho to sigma now, but sigma is still almost a homomorphism of EX to EX gamma to EXH. And now we know that sigma not only is essentially a homomorphism of these two, it also maps our first one just about onto the second one. So we have, in particular, a Y subset of X, which is Borel, conull, and H invariant, and we have a Borel inverse. I always draw those wrong. Tau inverse to sigma that takes y to x, and reduces in the opposite direction, E Y H to E X gamma. All right, so now we've reversed our picture. We started with everything going from gamma into H. Now I found one going from H into gamma almost everywhere. And this contradicts this last claim. We're almost done. So I'm going to reuse alpha because I'm out of letters now. So if alpha is a cocycle from H cross Y into gamma associated with this tau, and actually, you know, it's the same trick as this almost. We're taking alpha 1 and alpha 2 now, or the projections to the first and second copy of gamma, projections first and second copy of F2 in gamma. Then one of them has to be equivalent to a homomorphism trivial on A cross 1 by all the same stuff with a non-immutable range. Is equivalent to some an amount of Greek letters to what comes after rho? Shoot. No, every letter I can think of has been used. delta, what comes after delta? Epsilon?
There we go.
It's equivalent to epsilon, which is a homomorphism. Trivial on A cross 1 with non-amenable range. Okay, but this gives us a homomorphism if you look at it. We're looking at F2 cross H2 into F2 cross F2. So now this homomorphism will take will give us a map of H2 into F2, which is one of the things we said we couldn't have when we defined H2. It's gone. So anyway, this gives us, let's see, if we think about what is epsilon doing, epsilon goes from F2 cross H2, well, we can ignore the Y, and it goes into gamma, well, one of the copies of F2 in gamma, but it's trivial on A cross 1, which tells us it has to be non-trivial on H2. All right. So it gives us a copy of H2 inside F2. We know that can't happen from the assumptions about H2. So that's our contradiction. So if we unwind all of this, we realize that the one mistake we made was assuming that E was Borel reducible to F, assuming that was the one mistake we made. So this tells us that E can't be Borel reducible to F. All right, so now we have the Adams theorem done. There's some E subset of F so that E is not Borel reducible to F. And the two theorems of Thomas are essentially the same. We do all the same stuff, except let me just write down what we use real quick. It's actually all the same tricks. And we get all the same thing where we get this measure that looks the same on E and the thing that we're supposed to be embedding into. So the Adams proofs, or the, sorry, the Thomas proofs were, we want to say that 2E is not Borel reducible to E. And the point is that if it were, then we have two copies of X and some homomorphism rho that takes our two copies of X into one copy of X. Now we can look at, well, first off, the two copies of X have to be going to disjoint pieces of this X, or disjoint, disjoint invariant subsets of X. So we get two functions, rho 1 from X to X and rho 2 from X to X, representing sort of the two branches of this, so that they each one reduce, each reduces EX gamma to EX gamma. Sure, we can do that, but rho 1 of X intersect rho 2 of X is empty. All right, so this looks okay too, except now we run this whole proof again, except this time we use, instead of using H2 everywhere, we use F2 everywhere, and we ignore this piece. Oh, wait, not this piece. Where do we stop? Somewhere here. Oh, okay. We stop here. So we get this same, everything works the same up to this unique ergodicity gives us that these two measures are the same. So essentially what we get is we have a measure on X, and we get these two measures on X, two more measures on X. we know that this copy of X has measure 1 in here, this copy of X has measure 1 in here, and by all this other work, we get that the measure on here translates to the same measure here. So in fact, this copy of X has measure 1 in here. Same thing, this copy of X has measure 1 in here. So in particular, row 1 of X, sorry, measure of row 1 of X, the same as the measure of row 2 of X, is 1, and that contradicts that their intersection is empty. And we do the same thing again with the E cross I2, except in this case we assume that we have an injective homomorphism, and I think it's all the same proof in the end. We get that we have to have the same measure in the pre-image as in X, and there's too much stuff, so we get overlap. All right. So yeah, okay. I guess I'm done. Questions? Thanks.